You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been 15 years since the genocide in Rwanda. Yesterday, 20 people who concealed Tutsis during the killings were honored and awarded with certificates of merit and with starting up micro projects for their courage in opposing violence. Coincidentally, on the same day, Rwanda was named the world's top business reformer by the International Finance Corporation and the World Bank. Rwanda has come a long way since 1994, but as Joseph Seberenzi, a survivor of the genocide, reminds us in his memoir, God Sleeps in Rwanda, A Journey of Transformation, underneath the seeming stability, a lot of rage continues to boil. The book, co-written with Laura Mullane, is published by Hilsinger Mendelssohn East, and it brings Joseph Seberenzi to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you.
The title of your book, which is also the title of a documentary film?
Yes.
It comes from a saying in Rwanda, God spends the day elsewhere, but he sleeps in Rwanda. Is that because Rwanda is so physically beautiful or because of the brutality that's been so much a part of the country's history?
No, it's because of the beauty, the natural beauty of Rwanda. And it's also because of the peaceful coexistence between Hutu and Tutsi for centuries until colonization entered Rwanda.
But wasn't there always some kind of inequality in that peaceful coexistence?
Yeah, there were inequality, especially between the elite, which was essentially Tutsi, and the ordinary people, Hutu and Tutsi. So there were those inequalities that eventually were exploited by Belgians and by Hutu extremists to mount the ordinary Hutu against ordinary Tutsis.
So it was institutionalized with colonization. First, the Germans came in. Did they do anything, or was it just the Belgians who made the problem so bad?
Yeah, it was Belgians because Germans they ruled Rwanda using the what is called indirect rule. But before Germans came to Rwanda, there were injustices, there were inequalities. The king was from the Tutsi community, even though he tried to include people from both sides, but there were injustices. But eventually, Belgians, they even introduced the ethnic identity cards, and that was a seed for future violence.
They declared the Tutsis to be superior, actually.
They declared Tutsi to be superior. They declared Tutsi to be the cousin of white people. They declared that Tutsi came from somewhere else, not Africans. So all that was very harmful to the peaceful coexistence that existed between Hutu and Tutsi.
Now, Rwanda sits right above Burundi, which also is a country divided, Tutsi and Hutu. The same kinds of problems occurred there?
Yeah, absolutely. They occurred especially in 1965 and in 1972. And in 1972, there were massacres by Tutsi against Hutus. That was wrong. That was horrible.
Which I'm sure made an awful lot of Hutus fearful for their own lives in Rwanda and, of course, in Burundi.
Yeah, in Burundi, of course, they were fearful and many fled. They fled to Rwanda and the other neighboring countries. And this was also used by the Hutu-dominated government that was in Rwanda at that time to once again kill ordinary Tutsi who had nothing to do with what had happened in Burundi.
Now, Rwanda is about the size of Maryland.
Absolutely.
Burundi as well?
The same. Yeah.
And but the two countries have never been merged, even though they are so similar. What are some of the unique geographical features of Rwanda? Because we always talk about the one thing we have for the past 15 years or so. But you say it's a very beautiful country.
It's a very beautiful country. It's a country of 1,000 hills. You have rivers, rolling hills, you have lakes, you have all these type of animals, including mountain gorillas. So it's a beautiful country. The weather is so nice. And actually, there is a woman from New York, this great state that went to Rwanda in the 1950s. She loved Rwanda, and she decided to stay there. So the beauty is extraordinary.
That really has played no part in this in these problems, has it? Or have, for example, your family had owned land near the Congo border. Was that particularly rich land? Would you have owned it if you had been Hutu?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, ordinary Hutu and ordinary Tutsi were the same. In my clan, no one was ever in higher leadership, so we were the same. And my father basically acquired lands because he worked hard, because he was able to buy more land. And we lived near the lake on the other side of the Congo, near Lake Kivu. It was a wonderful place, and we lived with our Hutu neighbors in peace.
Yeah, the Hutus and Tutsis also lived in Congo. In fact, some of the problems from Rwanda and Burundi have spilled over into Congo.
They have spilled over.
Are these artificial borders?
These are artificial borders because Rwanda used to be bigger than it is today. But at the Berlin conference, they made up these artificial boundaries. So part of Rwanda was given to Congo, part of Rwanda was given to Uganda and Tanzania and so on, which means we have Hutu and Tutsi on the other side of the border in Congo. And that's why the conflict in Rwanda spills into Congo and the conflict in Congo spills into Rwanda. So it's a very complex situation. That's why to bring peace in Rwanda or in Burundi or in Congo, we need to work on a comprehensive strategy, a regional strategy to make sure in these countries we can live together in peace and enjoy the natural resources we have.
My guest is Joseph Sebarenzi, who was Speaker of the Rwandan Parliament from 1997 to 2000. His book, God Sleeps in Rwanda, A Journey of Transformation, is published by Atria Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. But is it true that you haven't been back to Rwanda since 2000?
Yeah, I have not been back since 2000.
What stopped you?
What stops me is that when I left, I feared for my life. I was going to be killed.
Even though you were the Speaker of the Parliament and Tutsis are once again pretty much in political power?
Yeah, absolutely. Because this conflict in Rwanda is, of course, ethnic, but it also has to do with dictatorship. So you can be harmed because of who you are, the ethnic group you belong to, or the region you come from, and also because of your political views. So in my case, when I left Rwanda in 2000, it was because of the work I was doing in Parliament, the work about accountability, because I wanted the Parliament to have all the powers to hold government ministers accountable, basically to have oversight, which in this country you take for granted. But in many countries in Africa, we don't have that. So I want to have that, make sure we have. So in 2000, I left Rwanda because of that. But earlier, I had also left Rwanda because of ethnic problems.
So President Kagame is a mixed blessing, would you say?
He's a mixed blessing, and I loved him. As a person, I love him. But I dislike his policies. I had much hope in him in 1994 because he helped to stop the genocide and he helped to bring back the country, but we thought he was doing this for the sake of democracy, for the sake of future generations, but he ends up being for the sake of his own power, his own security, which put in jeopardy future generation of Hutu and Tutsi.
And there's been some ambiguous politics involved in the border problems in Congo, where he seems to be playing both sides at different times.
Yeah, he did. First was in 1996, when he invaded Congo. And in Congo, the people who were involved in genocide were organizing to attack Rwanda. So it made some sense to go to Congo at that time. But the problem is that he went beyond these fighters and attacked ordinary Hutu. And he also got involved in 1998 again, and got involved actually since 1998 until now, I should say, he gets involved in that country, and he has created animosity between Congolese and Rwandan, which is wrong, which is bad.
Because he has put his support behind some of the insurrectionists who are out there right now, the rebel leaders, who are responsible for so many of the problems that Congo is facing in its east.
Yeah, there are these rebels in Congo who got help from Rwanda. There are other rebels who get help from other countries. And the issue is, of course, Rwanda getting involved, Rwanda not solving its political problem using political means, but also Congo not being able to set up strong institutions to have this country enjoy its extraordinary resources.
So all of its neighbors, Rwanda just being one, Uganda another, they all see this as an opportunity.
An opportunity to have access to immense resources that Congo has.
Now, I was surprised to read that your father, who's a farmer, was a Christian.
Yes.
Was also had three wives.
Yeah, he did.
I didn't think that was allowed.
It was not allowed. Actually, it was not allowed, and he was excluded from some of the benefit he had to enjoy from the church. But he practiced, and I explained in this book why he ended up having three wives. People can read in the book. But he's a man who taught us to love our neighbors, and who taught me that despite what Hutu had done to us, we should not shed blood, because when you do, you bring curse to yourself.
His first wife couldn't bear children, so he married a second wife, who was your mother.
That's my mother.
And then the first wife started having children, but then he married a third wife.
A third wife, yes. And when she married the third wife, it was when my uncle and his son were forced into exile in early 1960s. And the local mayor said, "We're going to take over the land, but if you want to keep this land, you need to marry another woman." So my mother took her cousin and gave her to my father.
How many children wound up
in
the family?
In total, I think we had 17. Mm. My mother had 10. Unfortunately, seven of them were killed in genocide in 1994.
So you lost seven siblings, and do you lose your parents as well?
Yeah, my mother was killed in genocide, and my father was also killed in genocide, and many relatives. And it's it makes me feel very bad, because if the international community had helped, they wouldn't have been killed. And of course, my fellow Rwandans are the most to blame, because there was no reason to attack ordinary Rwandans.
There were some acts of heroism, but not enough. We talked earlier about some people being honored just yesterday. We'll come back to that and talk about some of the other violence that preceded the genocide we all know about. There was violence of the 70s, wasn't there, that forced you to go to school outside the country. My guest is Joseph Sebarenzi. His book, God Sleeps in Rwanda, written with Laura Ann Mullane, subtitled A Journey of Transformation, is published by Atria Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. Stay with us. We're back with Joseph Sebarenzi, who was the Speaker of the Rwandan Parliament from 1997 to 2000. He was forced to leave his home country. These days, he is, among other things, a conflict management consultant for non-governmental organizations. He has written a book with the help of Laura Ann Mullane called God Sleeps in Rwanda, A Journey of Transformation. It is published by Atria Books. And it begins in the 1970s when your mother tells you that there are differences between Tutsis and Hutus. How old were you when she told it to you, and had you not realized it before?
I had not realized it before. Of course, I had heard of words Hutu and Tutsi, but it was until that night when we were getting ready to have our dinner, and she was a little bit upset, I could see, and then she said, you have no idea, but I had to go in the bush, hide with you, because if we had stayed in the house, we would have been killed. So when I started asking questions, killed by who, she mentioned Hutu, why they would kill us. She said, because we are Tutsi. That's when I really realized the differences, and then followed this crisis in 1973 when houses were burned and when we were almost to be killed.
And that Hutu rage was because they had felt that they had been pretty much disenfranchised, that they were being treated as second-class citizens, and they are the majority.
Yeah,
of Rwanda.
Yeah, they're the majority, and I don't think they felt they were really like a second-class citizen, because Hutu took power basically in 1959. So by 1973, it was enough to feel part of the system. And
so then why do you think it continued? Why do you think it got so bad that normal people were willing to do things that they might not, that they definitely would not have done under any other circumstances?
It was because of politics. It was because of opportunistic leaders who were at the top, and he asked people to get involved in this. He asked them to go after Tutsi, because the same president at that time, he was the one who behind the killings of Tutsi in from 1959, basically, until 1967. And between 1959 and 1967, there were approximately 20,000 Tutsi killed and approximately 300,000 Tutsi forced into exile.
What about your family? Were any members of your family killed then?
No, in our area, no one was killed, but in many parts of the country, people were killed.
And how was that resolved?
You know, it's not yet resolved, because it took place between 1959 to 1967. Then in 1973, when we thought it was safe, it happened again. And that's when my father, who realized that that crisis may occur again, he came to me and he said, we just survived. Now you need to leave and go to Congo. So if something bad happens again in this country, and if we are killed, at least someone in the family will survive.
So you were the only member of the family who left the country?
I was the only one who left.
And do you think that, well, obviously that changed you. Do you think it's the reason that later you could go into politics and do some of the other things? Would you have been a farmer otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. And possibly I would have been killed in 1994. I went there, and my father said, you need to go there. If we are killed, you will survive. And he said, by going there, you get an education. Education that I could not get in Rwanda. So I got the education.
You also met your wife.
And at the college in the University of Lubumbashi, I met my wife. I convinced her to go back to Rwanda.
Was she Rwandan?
She's Rwandan. She was a refugee. Her parents had left early 1960s. So came back to Rwanda. And I went again into exile when the war in 1990 started.
Were there signs? Because it seems to suddenly... at least all of the stories I've read and the films I've seen, this was something where there was some kind of a plan. But for most people, it came as a total surprise.
You know, for people familiar with Rwanda, it was not a surprise. There were signs. There were political assassination, especially after the war started in 1990. There were media calling for massacres. There were many people displaced by the war. So you could see it. That's why I decided to leave. I went to Burundi, stayed there, and from there I was able to bring one of my brothers, but all others, they stayed in Rwanda and they were killed. But eventually, after the crisis, I went back to Rwanda to help in reconstruction and reconciliation.
The pretext was that the president died in a plane crash?
Yeah, exactly. The president was killed in this crash, and immediately the genocide started. But the genocide, the death of the president was just a trigger. They were planned already. They were signed that Tutsi and the Hutu were opposed to dictatorship, opposed to the genocide of Tutsi, also be killed. And it happened. So it was not a surprise. And what surprised me is why the international community did not do much to prevent, as actually the former commander of the UN troops asked to do.
And we're talking about a lot of killing very quickly, at least 800,000 people in a little over 3 months. Some people estimate that it may be as many as a million.
Yes.
So that's how many a day? If it's 100 days and 800,000, that's 8,000 people dying each day, maybe 1,000.
And this is because, unlike the Holocaust, this was perpetrated by ordinary people using machetes, using spears. These were killings carried out by neighbors against their neighbors.
And a big shock to many people outside of the country is that the kinds of people we would assume would help, like members of the clergy, actually wound up becoming complicitous.
Yeah, some did help, and there were also many Rwanda, many Hutu who helped. But there were many we expected they would help, but they didn't help. I have family members who survived because they were Hutu who said, these are our brothers and sisters, we'll do all the best to help them.
Now, if somebody who hadn't lived in the area had just walked through your home village, would it have been easy for him to say, oh, that person's Hutu, that person's Tutsi?
You know, I discussed that in the book, but it's hard to tell. That's why these ID, the ethnic ID cards were used. So people ask your ID. If you were Tutsi because it was written in the ID, then you'll be killed. If you were Hutu, then you survive.
My guest is Joseph Sibarenzi. He's written with the help of Laura Ann Mullane, God Sleeps in Rwanda, A Journey of Transformation. It is published by Atria Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that all of this still wasn't the major turning point for you, that it actually was an encounter with the mayor of your old village?
Yes. You know, when I went back after the genocide, I was angry, of course, working with an American woman. I was doing research on prisons. In one of the prisons, I met the former mayor of my district.
He was a Hutu who'd been a good friend of your family.
A Hutu was a good friend of my family, but who got involved in the killings. When I saw him, of course, I was angry, but I did talk to him. But when I looked at how he had lost weight, how he was suffering, it reminded me when I was in prison how I suffered. So before I left that prison, I gave him money to buy food. That was surprising to the woman I was with. But the reason I did was not because I did not think he was involved, but I felt this man was a human being in need. And his behavior, and that is important, his behavior did not have to dictate my behavior. So I had to do what I had to do to help a human being in need.
But isn't this why Rwanda has instituted the reconciliation approach to work out the humanity of everyone involved?
Yeah, the Rwandan government has put in place reconciliation, these tribunals. But when you look closely what is being done, it's very superficial. It does not go deep to bring Hutu and Tutsi together as Rwandans, as human beings that have harmed each other, but who need to come together again.
Still, I know that if I had lost my whole family and I had watched them being killed in these days of chaos and rage, that I would be so angry. It would be very, very difficult for me to get past that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it happened to many people. And you can understand why some people got involved in revenge. But when you look beyond all the anger which we all have, and it's our right and it's natural, then you think, what will happen if you take revenge? And my thought is,
it keeps on going.
It keeps on going. The cycle of revenge keeps going. And I remember my this cycle of violence. It went from my grandmother to my mother to myself. And I believe it should stop. The only way it can stop is when we realize that by taking revenge, we keep this cycle going. Instead, we need to engage in reconciliation, talk with these people who harmed us, especially have this belief that we should not act like our offenders.
So you had this epiphany when you saw the mayor. And is that when you got involved in politics?
It's a part of it. Part of it. And another reason was when I visited the country, I saw what was going on. I saw the fear Hutu had. It reminded me the fear I had under Hutu regimes. And I felt there was something wrong. I felt the only way to stop this violence, I mean, it was for me to get involved in politics and policy making so that we can set up, policies that can promote a lasting peace and reconciliation in Rwanda. That's why you see, when I got elected speaker, I insisted that the parliament has these oversight powers. I insisted, but the president refused to sign the bill into law. Until I had to make a choice. I had a choice to sign it and then lose my job or even lose my life or leave this bill die and then remain in this dictatorship. So I signed this bill into law, but this was the beginning of my problems that led to my resignation later in 2000. But meantime, of course, because of that motivation, I said, let's treat all Rwandans equally. Let's have strong institutions, because it's only that way that we can ensure that our children, our grandchildren will live in peace.
Are Rwandan politicians still playing the ethnic card?
They are still playing
ethnic card.
People
are still saying, I'm Hutu and we have to hate Tutsis. I'm a Tutsi. We have to fear the Hutu.
There are some who do. And there are some who do. Others, Hutu and Tutsi, are open to have peace, live together in peace. And, of course, we need to have a good leadership. And I wish Kagame had really confronted these tough issues, especially the issue of justice, of course, to punish these people who were involved in the genocide, but also to have some accountability for the Tutsi who were involved in revenge and in war crimes. That's essential. But also in Rwanda, we need to really to tackle one of the issues of power. Get out this power struggle between Hutu and Tutsi and come up with a consensus democracy.
Isn't part of the problem that people blame the colonial, the situation that developed during colonial times for all of these problems? And often in Africa, we hear again and again, well, all of this was set into motion during the years of colonization, and it's hard for us to break free.
No, I don't believe that. I know that the colonialism has its part.
The legacy is still there.
The legacy is there. But 50 years of independence are enough to forge a lasting peace, to forge democracy and reconciliation.
Getting back to the genocide, a listener asks, could the West have realistically done anything to thwart the violence without becoming mired in an Iraq-type situation?
I think yes. A country like Rwanda, if President Clinton had come out forcefully and say, you need to stop. If you don't stop, I will get involved. it should have, it would have stopped.
Instead, what he did is after he landed on the tarmac of Kigali Airport, was it? And said, we're sorry. He got back on the plane and flew off.
Yeah, exactly. He came and I was there. We received him. We respected him. And actually, we were happy that he somehow apologized. But the apology does not bring my mother, my father, my siblings back. So it was good to apologize, and it was good to learn from that mistake and make sure it does not happen again.
Were you surprised that the IFC and World Bank labeled Rwanda one of the top business reformers, even in this terrible world economy?
It's the truth. It's the truth. Economically, President Kagame has done well. There is order, stability in the country. You can go anywhere. It's safe. But those key issues, structural issues, have not been dealt with. And remember, under previous regime, we had the same thing. Rwanda was held to be higher income per capita. Rwanda was called the Switzerland of Africa, but all of a sudden, there was this war in 1990, and eventually the genocide. So it can happen. We need to confront not these superficial issues like building infrastructure, having a clean city, but tackle the issue of power, issue of justice, and make sure we have strong institutions, not strong men. That way, we can have development, a lasting development, a lasting peace.
Considering what you feel about what the U.S. and the U.N. should have done during the genocide, what do you think should be done in Darfur? What do you think should be done now in some of the other killings that we're seeing in Somalia, for example?
You know, it's tough to say what exactly should be done. And I always insist on prevention than coming after the crisis has erupted. But since we have the crisis in Somalia, we have the crisis in Sudan, I think the world, especially these world powers, they need to come together as one people and say the people who are suffering over there are brothers and sisters. We need to help them. And so they can put pressure, especially in Sudan, on President Bashir, and they can bring him to a point where he would stop it. But until he gets support from some powers, then he will continue what he's doing. And on this point, actually, I should say that the U.S. has done well. The U.S. was the first to declare genocide, what was going on in Darfur. The U.S. has proposed many measures, but there are countries like China, Russia, they have not done much, so they should really come out and do something.
And what happened in Rwanda was also an example of the sort of attitudes that are different in different parts of the world. Some countries did want to go in. Mm-hmm. Others, I think France was one of the countries that resisted in the case of Rwanda. We have this situations again and again. We're seeing with Zimbabwe, where South Africa, the country that could apply the most pressure, is reluctant to do it, mm-hmm. to force Mugabe to change his approach. This is all very sad.
It's very sad, but once again, what we need from these powers, the U.S., France, and others, it's not to come with humanitarian assistance afterward. It's not to come and help, build infrastructures, though we need them. What we need most is to help build strong institutions, to help eradicate the structural violence we have in many countries. It's less expensive, and it's wise, and it's morally sound.
Joseph Savarenzi, his book, God Sleeps in Rwanda, A Journey of Transformation, published by Atria Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.